This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Securities and Exchange Commission finds itself in an unwelcome spotlight this week as new revelations appear daily in the Bernard Madoff Ponzi case. With the agency under fire, you might wonder who'd want the job of leading it. Today in Chicago, President-elect Barack Obama announced his pick. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Bigland in for Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could join us on this Thursday. It is the 18th day of December. The SEC is not a pretty place to be these days, with the financial industry imploding, scandals erupting. But Mary Shapiro apparently wants the job of reviving the agency. She previously served as an SEC commissioner, and she currently heads up the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. Shapiro faces a slew of problems at the agency that is supposed to police Wall Street, but increasingly finds itself derided as Keystone Cops. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
The reputation of the Securities and Exchange Commission has been battered in the past year. Charged with sounding the alarm if the nation's biggest investment banks were headed for disaster, it failed. This fall, John McCain called for the commission's Republican chair to resign. And then last week, Bernie Madoff was accused of the biggest financial fraud in American history. Still, Mary Shapiro says she wants this job.
Obviously, there's much work to be done there.
But what is the job she needs to do? Insiders say she'll need to boost morale, support the enforcement staff and investigators, while at the same time improving the agency's ability to recognize big risks facing regulated firms. So can Shapiro throw on a cape and some tights and save the SEC?
No. The problems of this agency run very deep.
Hal Scott's a law professor at Harvard and an expert in capital market regulation. He says Shapiro's well qualified, but
I think we have to create a new agency with a different culture to regulate the entire financial system.
Most observers agree America's system of financial regulation is hopelessly fragmented. Here's just a partial list of the agencies in this mix. There's the OCC, the OTS, the SEC, the FDIC, the CFTC, and the Fed. Yet even with all those regulators running around, Scott says no one is effectively keeping an eye out for big financial risks. And today, Obama said reforming this system would be one of his top priorities. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
It is bonus season on Wall Street, but this year the stockings aren't quite as stuffed as usual. Goldman Sachs is cutting partner bonuses by up to 80%. Morgan Stanley's bonus pool will be half as big as last year, and its executives won't take home a bonus, period. Credit Suisse is taking the unusual step of funding bonuses with proceeds from some of the bad assets it's been trying to take off its books. But all this begs the question, why is anyone on Wall Street getting a bonus this year? Here's Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson from New York.
When it comes to bonuses around Christmas time, I can't help but think of Clark W. Griswold in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. He had already put the down payment on a swimming pool when his bonus arrived.
It's a one-year membership in the Jelly of the Month Club.
Oh, God.
Clark, that's the gift that keeps on giving the whole year.
The problem, as Clark told his boss just minutes later, was this.
You don't want to get bonuses, fine.
But when people count on them as part of their salary...
And that is the problem with doing away with Wall Street bonuses, says Charles Elson, who directs the Center for Corporate Governance at the University of Delaware. He says bonuses are part of the salary because they incentivize workers to make money for the firm, sort of like tips for waiters.
I think when a bonus becomes sort of a normal part of the salary structure, then it's no longer a bonus. But the problem is, it's called a bonus.
Something that doesn't sit well with shareholders. Elson says the other problem is some employees haven't contributed to losses.
There are people in certain divisions that have had very good years and produced profits for the bank that offset some of the losses that were taken in the other divisions.
But what about bonuses that were based on pumped-up short-term gains? For that, banks can turn to clawbacks, taking back past bonuses that weren't really justified. Don't count on that happening, Elson says.
If I told you, we could expect a series of clawbacks on those banks, I have a very nice bridge for sale as well.
But firms may have to start repealing bonuses soon because, just like bridges, many banks are now funded by the taxpayer. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Chalk this one up for the little guy, at least the one who plunks down plastic at the store. Today, federal regulators approved new rules for the credit card industry. They're meant to protect consumers from surprise interest rate hikes and fees, but banks say they will hurt cardholders, whether they have good or bad credit. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Dave Gutman pays his credit card bill off every month, but his bank keeps giving him less time to do it.
Time from the due date has shrunk from the normal 30 days to 20 billing days.
The new rules say credit card companies have to give consumers 21 days to pay. They can't apply payments to high interest debts last, and companies won't be able to change the terms of your credit card based on your track record with other bills. Banks say as a result, even people with good credit will pay higher rates because it'll be harder to judge a person's credit risk.
Those people who manage their credit well will be paying an interest rate that is too high for their risk profile, and that will in turn subsidize those borrowers who have trouble managing their credit.
That's Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable. He says banks need more elastic rules for plastic. But Gail Hillebrand of Consumers Union says banks will use the new rules as an excuse to raise rates. And she doesn't think the regulations do enough for borrowers in trouble. For example, low rates still skyrocket permanently if you're late once, even if you mend your ways.
There's no requirement that after you've paid on time at the high rate for 6 months or 12 months, that you get your old rate back. So that's unfinished business that needs to be addressed.
Unfinished business that Hillebrand says Congress can wrap up. Lawmakers could also speed things up. Right now, the new rules don't go into effect until July of 2010. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
With so many U.S. companies finding themselves at penny stock status or in bankruptcy, the New York Stock Exchange is looking at putting a moratorium on its listing requirements. If it does, it would join the NASDAQ, which suspended its minimums 2 months ago. Meanwhile, on Wall Street, once again, oil prices proved a drag on the markets. Crude settled near $36 a barrel, and investors sent stocks down more than 2%. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, the White House confirmed that it's looking at, quote, orderly bankruptcy as an option for two of the big three automakers. Basically, the government would prop up GM and Chrysler for several months while an overseer comes in with a post-bankruptcy plan. But there's still no final decision. Wages and other labor costs have been a main source of contention in talks about the auto bailout, but the debate is about much more than hourly pay. Commentator Harley Shaken says the future of the economy is at stake.
Last week, Senate Republicans held the auto rescue hostage to slashing labor costs. Labor costs, however, didn't drive the automakers into this economic ditch, and gutting them won't pull the automakers out. At issue is what happens to the middle class. Labor costs, of course, are important, but low wages are not the secret to competitive success, nor are they without risk. The danger is they lead to a downward wage spiral, depressed purchasing power, and an economy based on the working poor. Since we're talking about Detroit, let's take a drive up Woodward Avenue. 4 miles north of the Detroit River is what remains of the Highland Park plant, where Henry Ford introduced the moving assembly line in 1913. A year later, Ford startled the world by doubling the prevailing wage to $5 a day, prompting many to claim this reckless act would bankrupt the industry. Instead, employee turnover went down, performance improved, and profits soared. What was the secret of this competitive success? Innovation and productivity, not low wages. The $5 day was a great start, but it took the birth of the UAW and other industrial unions in the 1930s to forge a long-term link between rising productivity and high wages. This link led to auto workers who could buy the cars they built, send their kids to college, and set a standard for workers throughout the economy. The flip side of high wages was what Walter Reuther, the legendary UAW leader, called high-velocity purchasing power. Our greatest economic success occurred when U.S. firms paid the highest wages in the world, not the lowest. When times are tough, slashing wages is always a powerful temptation. Low wages might fatten the bottom line next quarter, but they build exit ramps from the middle class next year. A superior product, high productivity, and high wages pave the road to a healthy economy and a decent society.
Harley Shaken teaches about labor and the economy at UC Berkeley. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. If you're looking to take your mind off things like, oh, unemployment, plunging home prices, Ponzi schemes, how about a trip to the stadium or maybe the arena? Sports have been generally immune from economic downturns, but not this time. Even major leagues, including the NFL and NBA, have had layoffs, and the situation is even worse for lower-level sports. The Arena Football League announced this week that it's suspending the 2009 season. Business Week sports editor Mark Hyman is with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tess.
So what happened to the Arena Football League?
About four or five of the franchises in big cities decided that they weren't going to be coming back in 09, and that left the league with six or seven franchises, and ESPN decided that it wasn't really interested in televising AFL with a six or seven team league, and for that reason, the league decided that it would take a hiatus and take 09 off.
How much of this is potentially related to the recession? Is this something where fans just decided they couldn't afford to go to the games?
I think, you know, part of it certainly is related to the economic meltdown and the expectation that corporate sponsorship would be hurt and that attendance would be hurt. But not all of it. I think that the league for some time has been looking to restructure and to come back as a single entity league where ownership would be centralized. And that eliminates competition among teams for player salaries and reduces payroll.
Does this mean that the AFL won't be coming back? I mean, is a hiatus a de facto bye-bye?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the league is talking as if it certainly will be back in 2010, but we know, I think, from history that that's not always the case. In 1986, the U.S. Football League took a year off with the expectation of certainly telling people that they would be back the following year, and there's never been another U.S. Football League game.
Well, Mark, I wonder, you know, the AFL is not the only league that is suffering right now. The WNBA in a bit of trouble, and the LPGA, I know, has canceled several tournaments next year.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a contraction in many of these second-tier sports. The WNBA is going to be entering its 13th season starting in May, and recently they lost the most prominent franchise in the league, the Houston Comets, who won the first four WNBA titles, leaving the WNBA with 13 teams for 2009. But, you know, the WNBA is a slightly different case. They're kind of tethered to the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And without the resources of the NBA, the WNBA probably wouldn't be here now.
Well, when we look at the recession's effect on some of these
non-major sports. Any silver lining you can see?
Well, yes. I think there are some sports that are going to benefit from this, some professional leagues. For instance, minor league baseball, I think, potentially could be a big winner, largely because it's a much more affordable option. You know, a Major League Baseball game now, if you can buy a ticket that allows you to see the field for less than $50, that's a pretty good deal. I mean, I was just on the website of the Aberdeen Ironbirds, the franchise nearest to me in Baltimore, and you can buy a season ticket for 38 games for $380. And I think people who are interested in watching professional baseball are going to find that a pretty attractive option this summer.
Mark Hyman is contributing editor for sports at Business Week and also the author of the forthcoming book, Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
Coming up, crusaders fight back against rural slavery in Brazil.
Unfortunately, we will have to stop the work that is being done here. What we would like you to understand is that we are defending your rights. We are defending your health.
But first, let's do the numbers. Can it get any worse? Apparently, Wall Street investors think so. Stocks sank for a second day on lingering credit worries, the ongoing limbo for car makers, and oil prices that keep sliding. The Dow fell 219 points, 2.5% to close at 8,604. The Nasdaq dropped 26 points, nearly 1.75%, ending at 1552. The S&P 500 lost 19 points, 2.1% to wrap up at 885. Oil prices drilled even deeper on word that OPEC's production cuts yesterday haven't really affected supplies. A barrel of crude slipped below $36 a barrel, the lowest it's been in 4.5 years. Investors are still waiting for the White House to deliver on a carmaker rescue plan. Stock in General Motors skidded 16%. Ford reversed more than 9%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Department of Labor reports on regional and state unemployment figures for November. The National Restaurant Association releases its industry forecast. It includes menu trends as well as ways for restaurateurs to keep cooking through the economic crisis. And leaving on a jet plane, you'll have company. The Air Transport Association predicts the busiest travel days this season will be on December 19th and 27th. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Brazil held its 10th annual oil rights auction today. The state-run company Petrobras was the big winner. With huge reserves along its shores, Brazil is emerging as an economic power. But South America's largest country has its share of growing pains, and it's where we go for the next profile in our series, Working, a look into the life of a single worker doing a job trying to get by. Today we focus on Brazilian government inspectors who are fighting the endemic problem of rural slavery. Inspection teams have freed 30,000 slave laborers in the last 10 years. Many of those jobs have direct ties to Brazilian exports of steel, cattle, soy, and ethanol. Sandy Tolan followed one young freedom rider who's on the front lines.
before dawn in the dirt parking lot of a bar called The Mustache in the middle of nowhere. Five of us are crammed into the cab of a pickup truck outside an Amazon town so hot it's known around here as the mouth of hell. We're waiting for the buses packed with workers bound for the sugarcane fields. In the driver's seat is Leandro Carvalho, an anti-slavery inspector from the Brazilian Ministry of Labor. His job? Find workers who are being abused.
We really hope we won't find degrading work conditions. But on the other hand, we also hope we do find them, because that's our work.
Leandro's 30 years old. Until recently, he was an insurance auditor near Rio de Janeiro's Copacabana Beach. He took a national exam to step up to a higher pay grade. He passed the test, left a beautiful fiance, and quickly found himself in the heart of a dark story he didn't know existed.
Yeah, I thought these were just stories.
Sometimes the inspectors uncover huge slavery rings, other times serious labor violations, other times nothing.
They are like detectives here.
And this is like a stakeout. Next to me in the truck, a federal policeman with his automatic rifle, just in case. A few years ago, three labor inspectors and their driver were murdered on the job. And now a bus passes. We can see the silhouettes of workers inside. Leandro pulls out of the lot and starts to follow the bus. High walls of sugarcane press in on either side of the truck. Leandro squints at the taillights of the workers' bus, dodging potholes in the blackness.
When I worked with insurance, what could I say about my job? But now I can really say that besides the adventure, I'm doing good for people.
Eu sou Indiana Jones moderno.
I'm a modern-day Indiana Jones.
We follow the bus until it stops in a field. Leandro gets out, talks to the workers, and learns they're actually well-paid mechanics. He shrugs. Even Indiana Jones can't cash in on every tip. We turn back.
Important information and good news. Now we get the breakfast in the hotel.
But in the afternoon, a new tip and a different story. Another cane field. Through the tinted windows, the sugarcane floats in the breeze in undulating waves. These stalks will be turned into ethanol, one of Brazil's fastest-growing exports. With Leandro at the front, the inspection team quickly fans out as startled workers look up, their faces blackened by the grit and sweet smoke of burning cane. Some continue sharpening their machetes. Others stop and look warily around at their bosses.
Just going to describe the situation we're in right now. There are a half dozen investigators, federal inspectors, along with federal police, one with his M16, and then people with clipboards doing interviews with workers.
A few hundred yards away, we find Joel da Silva, wiry and dark, and oblivious to the unfolding drama.
This work is for crazy people. You wake up at 4 in the morning, work all day. The entire body hurts so much. The legs, the arms, the spine. In this work, a lot of people get their backs really ruined.
Joel grabs a handful of burnt cane stalks and slashes downward, and then repeats the action again and again all day long under the pounding Amazon sun. He's about 40. He looks 60.
You know how poor people are. A friend comes and says, oh, there is a good job over there. We go and get accustomed to it. I brought my family here, but then they left.
On a dilapidated bus used to transport the cane cutters, Leandro is writing up a list of violations. No place for the workers to eat, little or no shelter from the relentless sun, no decent place to go to the bathroom, no protective goggles. Leandro tells the foreman this operation will be shut down. Leandro stands in front of the bus and addresses the workers.
Unfortunately, we will have to stop the work that is being done here. What we would like you to understand is that we are defending your rights. We are defending your health.
He reassures them they will be paid in full for the entire week's work. The atmosphere lightens considerably. Today, for a change, the men will go home early. And at a place where word of this raid will spread like brush fire, inspectors say, the entire industry has been put on notice from the federal government. We're watching.
Hey.
Next morning, Leandro sits shirtless and cross-legged on his bed. Yesterday's raid is still on his mind. But he says he's seen much worse. Workers held against their will, killed if they try to escape, while the rest, terrified, live as slaves.
Pessoas alojadas em barracões de lona, no meio do mato.
People living in plastic tents, in the middle of the forest, drinking the same water as the cows. They are in debt, they get no salary, and the broker pays them only drugs, alcohol, and marijuana. When I see this, I get really disgusted. And sometimes, I want to just shake the employer and ask him, have you no fear of divine punishment?
Leandro says, I can't understand how divine wisdom allows this to happen. He looks out the hotel window, then down at his hands.
Maybe the father up there in the sky wanted a guy from Copacabana that went to the beach every day to get out of that situation and transform this reality. Who knows?
Leandro's given up a lot to be here. His friends, 1,000 miles away, their weekly soccer games, the embrace of his family, and most of all, his fiancée, who broke off their engagement. She couldn't handle the distance and time apart. Instead of leading the life of an insurance man with a family plan on the beach in Rio de Janeiro, Leandro shares a bachelor pad with 3 other guys in the mouth of hell. But you won't hear him complain.
É bom você também se revolucionar. Eu acho que eu me revolucionei pouquinho.
I went through a revolution. And it's really good to go through a revolution. I think this is a really long-term job because we want to change a culture and we don't change a culture overnight. It takes decades, centuries. It's difficult. You only do that with your eyes on the prize.
Você só faz isso realmente com olhos no prêmio no futuro.
And with that, he pulls on his shirt, affixes his inspector's badge, and heads out toward the fields of sugarcane.
Our profile was produced by Sandy Tolan and Petra Costa, working as a collaboration with Homelands Productions. For pictures of Leandro Carvalho's work and audio of all the previous working profiles, go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, Burger King is taking the notion of beefcake to a whole new level. The fast food chain is selling a whopper of a holiday gift for your loved one, meat-scented body spray. Because nothing says romance like the smell of grilled flesh. The company is milking the story for all it's worth with a special website featuring the Burger King in naked recline by a cozy fire. To which all I can say is, holy cow. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today the Dow dropped 219 points, 2.5%. The Nasdaq fell 26 points, almost 1.75%. And the S&P lost 19 points, 2.1%. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, judging a product by its cover.
The packaging needs to be a merchandising tool. It has to look good. It has to reflect our brand values. So for us, packaging, the look of it is a critical element of the success of the brand.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.